There are people coming in, so. You look like you're in charge.
Don't worry.
Okay, hope everyone's having a meaningful fast and continue to have a meaningful fast. And I could just please ask everyone after the shiur to return the source sheet. We pulled a little bit of a switch. I had intended one topic for today, the topic which was publicized, but I wasn't aware of some of the dynamics in different places I was speaking, so we are going to shift the topic a little bit. We won't be discussing why the second base, why the first base of Mikdash failed. It's a topic in and of itself importance, but a different topic, but we're going to need the source sheets because we have to use them for a different shiur. So please, after the shiur, if anyone wants the source sheets, I'll be happy to send it to you or make them available. Last night, we sat on the ground, and I don't want to greet everyone or thank you for being greeted. It's not in the spirit of Tisha B'Av, but certainly it's nice to try to be misabel together. Certain types of avelos are better affected individually. Certain types of avelos have an energy that's collective and that's synergetic. So getting together and thinking about Yerushalayim is something which I value and you should be applauded for. Last night we sat on the floor and we began the entire process with one iconic word. Echa yashva badad, ha'ir abasiyam, ha'isa levad. And at a literal level, the word echa is inquisitive. How? And we expect an answer. And to a degree, the Megillah of Echa provides an answer. But Yirmiyah wasn't the first nor the only person to employ the term echa. Yirmiyah scribes Megillah Echa. Moshe Rabbeinu already preceded him and already preempted him. And to a degree, Yeshaya also employed the same term. Source number four. Shlosha nisnabu b'lashon Echa. Three Nevi'im employed the same term. Moshe, Yeshaya, v'Yirmiyah. Moshe, of course, we read yesterday, or 2 days yesterday. We read it in the Echa Trop, so it should be familiar to you. Echa salavadi tarchachem emasachem berivchem. It's the only pasuk in the Torah which we apply Echa Trop to. So Moshe chanced upon the word Echa. Yeshaya, Isaiah, also employed the term Echa, and it featured in yesterday's famous Haftarah, Haftaras Chazon, which lends Shabbos the name Shabbos Chazon. So source number two, Yeshaya, is in Perek Aleph, but of course we know it from the Haftarah. Echa ha'isa lezona kirya ne'amana. Noyasa mishvat tzedek yalin ba v'etam eratzchim. Yeshaya is contemplating the transition of a city that stood for morality, integrity, decency, privacy, into a salacious, vulgar, almost prostituted city. Echa ha'isa lezona. And then, of course, the most famous employment of the term Echa, Yirmiyah, source number three, Echa yeshva badad ha'ir abasiyam ha'isa kamara. So Chazal sense the redundancy of the term Echa. The Medrash, again, Shlosha nisnabu b'lashon Echa. Source number four, Yeshaya, Yirmiyah v'Moshe. Moshe, Echa salavadi tarchachem masachem v'rivchem. Yeshaya, Echa ha'isa lezona. Yirmiyah, Echa yeshva badad. But not only are these three terms employed by three different Nevi'im, but at three very different stages of Jewish history and in three vastly different conditions of national experience. Moshe, source number four, line three, Ra'as Yisrael b'chvodam. Who can imagine a better moment in Jewish history than the moments immediately prior to Har Sinai? psukim in Parshas Devarim, Echa, Salavadi, are essentially a redo of Parshas Yisro, where Yisro views his son-in-law Moshe almost preoccupied from dawn till dusk, dealing with all the questions, the search for spiritual meaning. Those of us who see the scenes in the beginning of Parshas Yisro, it's overwhelming for Moshe, and Yisro begs his son-in-law to delegate some of that authority to secondary teachers and educators. And Moshe is recollecting, the volume was just too onerous. I had to distribute it to others. So Moshe utters the word Echa in a moment of Jewish triumph. The Medrash continues. Yeshaya, source number 4, line 2 from the bottom, Ro'osam bepachzusam, saw them during the period of national unraveling. At the Nadir, on the first base Hamikdash, the intended topic of today's share, we switched the topic for those who walked in a bit late. Sometimes we glorify the past. It's both intellectually dishonest and it's morally enfeebling. So if everyone in the past were righteous and great tzaddikim and we're all fallen angels or fallen people and midgets, it's not true. In certain areas, people before us were more accomplished. And in certain areas, they were less accomplished and were more accomplished. The first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, witnessed a total and complete breakdown of any moral sensibility. People were deceitful, conniving, exploitative, hypocritical. They thought they could hide behind ritual and ceremony, and Yeshaya rails against this. Adulterous, paganistic, they just uncovered shrines, death tombs, mausoleums up north, and people bury themselves next to their idols. It's horrifying to imagine. They didn't keep Shabbos in the first Beis HaMikdash. Yoshio, the Melech who dies and whose death is commemorated or enshrined in that third parak of Echa, tries to reinstate Shabbos observance. So Yeshaya witnesses this grotesque scene, and he says, Echa Yisrael Lazona, how could you become such a prostitute? With the term prostitute, it's more of a metaphor, although it's also literal. Yirmiyah, the Medrash continues, Ro'osam b'nivulam. Last line, saw them in their disgrace, and their ugliness, and their contempt and shame, and said the term Echa. Three Nevi'im, three different periods, same terminology. Who cares? It's a word game. Serendipitously, they all happen to find the same word. It's an innocent enough word. Why are Chazal so mindful of the triple deployment of this word? And why is it so important that three people use the word Echa? Three people also use the word Vaidaber or Yisrael. Chazal is celebrating the redundancy of three different Nevi'im. Evidently, there's something iconic about the word Echa. The term Echa captures something pivotal about Jewish history, its trajectory, its various evolutions. The term Echa literally is translated as how. There are many different drashos, I'm sure. It's the end of Tisha B'Av. So many of you have heard of the association. I'll speak about this, Mirat Hashem, the next year, Echa and Ayeka. But at its root, the word Echa means how. And there are two different employments of the word how. One is interrogative or inquisitive. How do I travel? How do I get to the gas station? How do I bake a cake? How do I fix a computer? You solicit an answer. How? Eich. But then there's another type of eich. And that's a rhetorical how. Sometimes when we face experiences or phenomena, which just boggle our imagination, are too perplexing to compute. They lay beyond the pale of classic cognitive ration. It baffles us. We're overwhelmed. Think sometimes when you hear about a tragedy that you just didn't expect, and sometimes your immediate response is, how did that, what could that, what does that mean? How? And that person isn't soliciting an answer. Well, the person died in a car accident or died of cancer. It's just a response that's almost natural. It's almost nervous. How could something like that happen? How could, it's rhetorical. It's not inquisitive. The term Echa for Moshe, for Yirmiyah, and for Yeshaya is not an inquisitive or interrogative how. It's a rhetorical how. It stands in front of the specter of Jewish history and the irrationality of Jewish history and the asymmetry of Jewish history, and it recognizes how disproportionate our national and historical timelines are. We are not a normal nation. We do not submit to the classic dynamics of peoplehood and nationhood, the rules, so to speak, which govern most of human anthropology, politics, and experience, are simply inapplicable to God's people. We hover above history. Torah hovers above history. They try to eliminate Torah in France. If you try to eliminate Torah, you're essentially propagating it. And France turned into a center of Torah. When Rashi grew up in the 11th century, he couldn't find anyone to teach him Torah in France. He had to travel to Germany. No one could teach him Torah in France. And then he returned, and France became the epicenter of Torah. Rabbeinu Tam, the Balei HaTosfos. Torah hovers above history. The Greeks tried to extinguish Torah, and all it did was led to this burst of the Tanoim and the Amoraim, which occurs more or less in the aftermath of the Hanukkah event. They tried to emasculate our Torah 80 years ago. And just look around. I mean, it's Tisha B'Av, so we don't want to celebrate Torah. But there's more Torah being studied in today's world than at any point since the first Beis HaMikdash. And I asked very serious people this question. Is it true? And they said, of course it's true. Maybe not the depth, but the spread of Torah? Unprecedented. 80 years after our great Torah scholars were bowdlerized, Torah hovers above history. The Jewish people are compared to the sand. They're compared to the stars. Also compared to blades of grass in a pasuk in Yechezkel. And the commonality between all these metaphors is the multitudes of Jews that inhabited and will one day inhabit. But each and every one of those metaphors possesses nuanced differences. And one unique component of the stars is that we look down upon this earth. We're not part of this atmosphere. We're not part of the cycle of laws that govern human experience. Kochvei HaShemayim LaRov. And Jewish history will always be disproportionate. And it will always be irrational. And it will always confound the imagination if you try to chart it based on the textbooks you've studied in university and the rules and laws which govern humanity. And that reality, the irrationality of Jewish history, is captured by the term Eicha. And there's an algorithm. There's a consistency. It's lopsided at every stage and in every manifestation. When we succeed, we transcend and surpass all metrics of human success. When we unravel morally, it's beyond belief, beyond prediction. And when we suffer, and as Tisha B'Av has reminded us, we suffer beyond human imagination, beyond any narrative which governs other human and other cultures and other empires when they suffer. Moshe beheld the Jewish people 5 weeks maybe, 6 weeks possibly after Yetzias Mitzrayim, 6 weeks after Yetzias Mitzrayim, a band of slaves, backbeaten into servitude. Slaves in Egypt were forced to walk around naked without clothing. Slavery isn't just indenture or apprenticeship. They were enslaved. They were spat upon. They were raped. They were mocked. They were dehumanized. And 5 weeks later, they're grasping at monotheism, which is a very complex religion. Who is Hashem? How can we better understand him? This spiritual thirst. More often than not, people who suffer lapse into survivor mode. It's called putting one foot ahead of the other. It's trying to survive. Their imagination shrinks. The horizons of culture and of perception shrivel. And here, this band of slaves. One of the great miracles of the Independence War was not just that we defeated the invasion of multiple legions of Arab armies, but that we defeated them with a band of ragtag refugees. And it's not just that they weren't trained, but the psychological toll of being persecuted and exploited. We live today, unfortunately, in a world in which we recognize the psychological toll of verbal abuse, physical abuse, racial abuse. Could you imagine sustained abuse, multi-generational. We were born into slavery, and you know no better. And all of a sudden, there's people who have God's spirit in their veins, 5 weeks later, are peppering Moshe with questions. Day in day. As a derech yelchuba, as a maser asher yason in Parshas Yisro, Moshe is just befuddled. Echa salavardi. How could this growth be so phenomenal? You're slaves. You should be interested in your food, not in your spirit. You're interested in some land that you'll gain, not in the afterlife or understanding some God in heaven and the intricacies of religion. That's whom Jews are. Then Yeshaya stood about 180 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and he just couldn't fathom it. It should be so obvious to you. It should be so clear and painstakingly obvious. The breakdown of leadership. The priests, the prophets, full of graft and corruption, self-serving interests, moral hypocrisy, preaching righteousness and abusing the vulnerable. And at that point, it should have been obvious, not just because of some abstract moral code. You lost 80% of your population a few years ago. Yeshaya speaks to the nation after 10 tribes are lost. Try to absorb the shock of what it means to lose 80% of your population. Imagine the people you know in Manchester, if 80% of them disappeared. It would be apocalyptic. It would be dystopian. Of course you'd reckon. Of course you'd process. What happened? What's the cause of this effect? How do I compute the loss of so many, and how do I alter my behavior? Nothing. No response. Everyone's pursuing their merry lifestyles. Ish kal yashar v'ein av yaseh. Prostitution, murder, rampant idolatry, lack of Shabbos observance, seething hatred to Nevi'im. You know how many Nevi'im were murdered? I mean, they were just mocked or sneered at. That we mock and we sneer at rabbis on Shabbos afternoon. Nevi'im were killed or murdered. Zechariah, Beis Hashem, Yom Kippur, Shabbos, and Yom Kippur fell on Shabbos one year. They murdered him right in the Beis HaMikdash. As they did Uriah HaChiti, they pursued Yirmiah. They banned Yirmiah. Yirmiah was a Kohen. They banned Yirmiah from the Beis HaMikdash. He couldn't show up there at peril of death. And Hashem has to coax him into issuing his prophecy because he knows what awaits him. Stoning. And Yeshaya just doesn't get it. If a Beis HaMikdash, every day you witness miracles. Every day you offer sacrifices. It's not that long ago that your grandparents left Egypt and crossed the sea, and your story is still... We know stories from 400 years ago. We have stories of the Vilna Gaon, of our great-great-grandparents. Just, you've been told the stories. Yeshaya just doesn't grasp it, but that's... We're very potent people. We live with the spirit of Hashem. We find ourselves and believe in ourselves through capabilities that surpass the ambitions and the aspirations of others. We don't accept our reality. We're in constant ferment. We're very stiff-necked. We're intransigent. We have the confidence of the Beis HaMikdash. We have the Beis HaMikdash. Perhaps all behavior could be exonerated or cleansed. And that sends a false confidence. It's very dangerous. Very dangerous in today's modern state of Israel. We're living through redemption, a restored state. We're invulnerable. That type of conversation is never cautious and never responsible. It's even more intellectually uninformed 80 years after the Holocaust to feel so confident in where we're heading. Caution, precaution, conservative, optimistic, but not in any way bravado. And of course, Yirmiyah sees the destruction. Yirmiyah sees the cosmopolitan Yerushalayim that had descended into isolation and been banned of human trespass. I don't know where you'll be and quoted on the source sheets, but if you are home today, between now and the end of this year and the end of the tzom, just Google Mark Twain traveling through Palestine. Mark Twain was not just an author, but a biographer. He wrote a diary, traveled, and listen to his rendition of the land of Israel in those days, Palestine, in 1867, a land cursed by God, a land that could not grow vegetation, a land without inhabitants, bearing the divine curse. Cities rise and fall, cultures come and go. It doesn't lead to a scorched earth policy, to the entire abandonment of peoplehood. But he witnessed the hatred, he witnessed the destruction, he witnessed the burning and ransacking of the Beis HaMikdash, the large-scale hostage-taking. And he said, Eicha. And it was the same. It was the same algorithm, it was the same truth. We hover above history. Jewish history can't be charted, not when we succeed, not when we fail, and unfortunately sometimes not when we morally misbehave. And for Moshe, Yeshaya, and Yirmiyah, respectively, the only response was no response, was to be perplexed, was to be confounded. Say, how to make sense of this? How to appreciate this? Baruch Hashem, we're veering closer to Moshe Rabbeinu Zecha. Having lived through so many years of Yirmiyah Zecha, look back at our people, at our country, how we've struggled over the last 70 years, or in a larger framework, the last 100 years or so, if you want to frame the emergence of the return to our homeland, the Holocaust, the entire process, the tumult that history has experienced. Sometimes people are looking for answers. How do you know it's redemptive? How do you know it's divine? There's certain markers, the blooming of our land. The land simply would not give her fertility to strangers. Mayan ganim, gan na'ol achosi kala, gal na'ol, mayan chatum. It's a pasuk in Shir Shirim. In that pasuk, it describes the virtue of the woman, Am Yisrael, who refused to allow anyone to enter her garden, only waiting for her husband. Gan na'ol achoti kala, gal na'ol, mayan chatum. But it's a pasuk that I think about very often when I think about Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael remained a closed garden, closed for business. Empires came and went. They tried to colonize. And not just empires, not just second-rate nickel-and-dime empires. Major world powers tried to settle this land, tried to establish empires, till it for its fertility, allow it to bloom. Eretz Yisrael remained stronger than their greatest efforts. It didn't give of its potency, of its depth. It waited for its children. Eim Abanim Smecha. Eretz Yisrael is likened to a mother. Some countries call their homeland the fatherland. We refer to it as the motherland. Eim Abanim Smecha waited for its children to return. Miraculously, the bloom, the desert, the water, even though we have limited water, it's part of the bloom, our ability to complement her fertility with our own efforts to desalinate water and to maintain this beautiful country that we've built. And so many other metrics. The return of people from across the globe, 52 different dialects. As I mentioned before, the spread of Torah beyond dimension. Part of it is also the historical tumult. As history reaches its end point, it has an accounting. And sometimes that, it's like an accountant. You have to make sure the numbers work. And those who deserve reward have to be rewarded, and those have to be punished, and countries have to be reshaped, and boundaries. Boundaries used to last 500 years. Today, national boundaries maybe last 5 minutes. Between national wars, international wars, racial skirmishes. History is convulsing, just as it did in Mitzrayim. Paros used to reign for hundreds of years. In Parsha Shmos, we meet at least 3 paros. The paro with which the Parsha begins, Vayakam Melech Chadash, the new paro, Shelo Yadas Yosef, and then Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim. 4 paros. 4 paros in 1 parsha? Hayitachin? Kol Nodei Nezeh Ba Medalek El Harim Mekapes Alak Vos. Hashem comes bounding over the mountains. History comes bounding. There's a personification of history. History is in movement. History is changing. How many nations are failing before our eyes? And not just in 2018. Thinking of history, if anyone here is a history student or history major or interested in history, the minimum quantity of years that have to be computed to appreciate historical sweep is 150. You can't judge history in 35 years. What has happened over the last 150 years to humanity, not just politically and militarily, but also culturally and existentially?
And we're living through Moshe Rabbeinu's Eicha. We're living through, how can we be so wealthy, Baruch Hashem? And there's such a high standard of living across the globe, relatively. 80 years after at least a third of our collective wealth was stripped, stolen, taken from us. Our intellect, our family, Baruch Hashem, Manchester, solid family life. What does it mean to rebuild families two generations after we didn't have families? How many of your parents or grandparents actually knew their grandparents? Or even had, I had grandparents. I didn't really have grandparents. I had broken grandparents. I remember my step-grandmother. I maybe spent three evenings my entire life in the same house as my grandfather. Because my step-grandmother had lived through Kristallnacht. And there were two things she could not tolerate. Children and glass. Because she had seen and heard so much glass being shattered. And she had seen children being dragged by their hair through the streets of Vienna. I think evidently, I think she was Viennese. I hardly knew her. I'd walk in with my grandfather. We'd have a meal together for an hour or two on paper goods. And we'd leave. We'd be shuttled out of the house before. Who knows what would happen to my step-grandmother. My mother's grandfather was no better off emotionally in terms of his ability to serve in a grandfatherly role. He's a great man, but certainly wasn't the grandfather who would take me on his lap and tell me bedtime stories. And yet, the type of families we've built and the types of communities, that's who we are. We defy historical graphs. We don't wait for the curve, the sine curve to undulate. We don't wait for the natural progression. We surge, and we spiral into death spiral sometimes. And that's why the word Eicha was so evocative for Chazal. And the truth is, there was a great visionary years later who understood the disproportion of Jewish history and the algorithm of that disproportion. And it was Rabbi Akiva. It wasn't just Moshe, Yirmiyah, Yeshaya. If there's one person who's the, I hate to say the celebrity, but the pivot of Tisha B'Av, it's Rabbi Akiva. He is the man who martyred himself, the first Jewish martyr in history to recite Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. He is the man who believed that redemption had come 70 years after the destruction of the Mikdash because he assumed it would repeat the same patterns and he supported Bar Kokhba, much to his despondency. He is the man of great perseverance. He taught 24,000 students and watched them all die. What would happen if you suffered a calamity of that magnitude? You'd crawl into a fetal position. And Rabbi Akiva decided, we don't know Hashem's ways. They're beyond us. I can't explain the death of 24,000 budding Talmidei Chachamim. But one thing I do know, I can teach five more. And he taught five new Talmidim. And those five Talmidim weren't just Talmidim. Their names were Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua. Between Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Yehuda, basically you've covered 95% of the Tanaim's literature. Stam Masnisa and Rabbi Meir, most Mishnayos are quoted the name of Rabbi Meir. Stam Sifra, Rabbi Yehuda, Stam Sifri of Shimon. So instead of retreating and withdrawing, he literally rebuilt Torah. It's hard to imagine if you compose a list of the top five heroes of our Masara, it's almost impossible to leave Rabbi Akiva off of that list. Almost impossible. I can't imagine any list that doesn't incorporate Rabbi Akiva. Akiva traveled to Rome to petition on behalf of the Jewish needs. You can't imagine a more pathetic scene. You can't imagine a negotiating team with less leverage. As the Mikdash is destroyed, the Jews are being pursued like dogs. And Rabbi Akiva and his entourage come begging the emperor, maybe, let a few live. Almost like the Jewish councils in the ghetto. What type of leverage, what type of authority did they have? So Rabbi Akiva lives the Chorban at every turn, facing the prospect of a Yom Kippur without the Beis HaMikdash, which is devastating, which was apocalyptic. Rabbi Akiva told everyone it's not about the Beis HaMikdash, it's about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ashrechem Yisrael. The Mishnah in Yomo and Pevav. So Rabbi Akiva is walking on the famous story, he's walking on the Temple Mount, with his colleagues, and they see some rodents and foxes scampering around Shu'alim Hilchuba, and they break down crying. Rabbi Akiva is always having these conversations or long seders with his colleagues in Bnei Brak. This is the seder team. And he breaks down crying. They break down crying. Famous Gemara in the end of Makos. Source number 7. He laughs. Only a visionary could laugh. Rabbi Akiva was a visionary. It's called having a fresh set of eyes. It's called not falling into the prejudice of convention. Here's an outsider. Spent the first 40 years looking at life from the outside. Sometimes we're so riveted on our reality that our eyes don't see. We just fall into songs that constantly run in our heads, and we adapt reality to accommodate the songs. Look at life fresh, without prejudice, without expectation, without labeling. Try to process life as it hits you. Of course, the problem is it takes time, and we don't really have time. So prejudice is our excuse for real in-depth analysis. We want to tag people, whether we see them, where they daven, where they live, how they dress, what they do for a living, their gender. It takes too much time to get to know ideas and people and really render ideas and judgment about whom they are or their values. So Rabbi Akiva, he starts laughing. I say, why are you laughing? He says as follows. Listen carefully, because it's a Gemara that many of you know, but there's a layer that I'm not sure you're sufficient, or you may not be sufficiently sensitive to. So there are two Nevi'im. One Navi was a Navi named Uriah, who sadly enough was murdered. And he prophesies about the destruction. His prophecy was about rats and foxes scampering over the Beis HaMikdash. There was another Navi called Zechariah. He prophesies about Geula. And his famous prophecy was, Od Yeshu Zekenim Zekenos Berchavos Yushalayim Mish Mishantal Biyadom Berav Yamav Berchavos Er Yimalu Yiladim Biyaladas Misachkim Berchavos Er. Bottom source. Not redemption. The streets of Yushalayim will be filled with frolicking children and men and women old enough to use canes. They didn't meet each other, Zechariah and Uriah. They lived at different time periods. Nothing in common. They hardly knew each other. They didn't even prophesize about the same period. Uriah spoke about the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, and Zechariah spoke about the redemption, Lasid Lavo. And yet, for some strange reason, Yeshaya, a different Navi, juxtaposes them in one pasuk. Source number 5. V'yayidili edim ne'manim. Yeshaya says, I've got two witnesses. A prophet is a witness. A prophet bears testimony. I have two witnesses, two prophets. As Uriah Kohen v'Zechariah ben Yevarechya. Why is Yeshaya juxtaposing two Nevi'im who hardly knew each other and didn't even speak about the same topic? We keep a reason. It's because Yeshaya is drawing our attention to some overlap. There's some common denominator between Uriah and between Zechariah. And that is why I'm smiling. Because they both sense the disproportion of Jewish history. Because Uriah prophesies about foxes, and the Romans pursued the Jews relentlessly, mercilessly. Their hatred for the Jews knew no bounds. Rome discovered the great secret of empire, not to eliminate their enemy, but to subdue them and to collect coin and soldiers for the expansion of their empire. They built the doctrine of sustainability. Sustain your enemy rather than ravage them. They'd march into town, pillage, rape, burn a few houses, kill a few leaders, and then set the terms and conditions for the cities or the villages' surrender. And that's how the Roman Empire began expanding slowly but surely. But their hatred to the Jews knew no bounds. The amount of garrisons they sent to defeat us, and the pinnacle of that hatred was what we read about this morning, the 10 martyrs. The effort they placed to pursue them, to apprehend them, to murder them in public fashion, in creative, diabolically creative fashion, was just the sign of their seething hatred. In ways, quite frankly, that far outstripped Nebuchadnezzar. Far outstripped Nebuchadnezzar. When the city of Beitar was defeated in the year 70, 130 AD, They found barrels of heads with tefillin on them. Typically, when you decapitate someone, you'd expect the tefillin to fall off the head. There's some commotion, there's some movement. Decapitation, not that I've ever experienced it or want to, but I imagine it's not a steadying experience. You have to fasten your seatbelt. If at the, for the very least, to create counter tensions, the decapitate. And all of a sudden, they made sure the tefillin were still on the heads. That's how much they detested Hashem and his people. 400 heads of tefillin. Or 400, excuse me, I think 400 volumes, 400 pounds of heads of tefillin. In barrels. A line near Beitar. Because we're not a normal people. Because we reflect Hashem. Because we challenge them to be monotheists. They still weren't there yet. They still found the luxury of polytheism, of Zeus and Apollo and Diana. They found that just too comfortable. Challenged to live by one God and one set of rules and a hierarchy of superiority where Hashem dictates and human beings obey. It's too much for their imagination. It would wreck and threaten their lifestyle. And they had to eliminate us at the root. Do you imagine if Hitler would have diverted all of the resources he employed to exterminating every last Jew in Hungary to the Western and Eastern Front? You may be living in Germany now. The war may have turned out vastly different. Some level, he just hated us so deeply that it was self-destructive. And Uriah saw this. He saw that the Jewish people do not live through typical patterns of experience at a national or collective level. And Rabbi Akiva saw Uriah's prophecy. He saw Jewish history unfolding. This is more or less the turn of Jewish history. More or less. Until the second destruction, the destruction of the Second Temple, more or less Jewish history could have been charted through natural trajectories. Sancheirev didn't have it out specifically for the Jews. Sancheirev captured and redispersed the entire Mediterranean crescent. Nebuchadnezzar dominated every empire. Haman probably is the advent of particularly targeted anti-Semitism at a historical level. Obviously, Esav launches it, but Haman effects it and expresses it in history. But at this point, they sensed that history was becoming anti-Semitic, that the great night of Gullus, the great reign of Esav, was beginning. And Rabbi Akiva started laughing. He said, well, now I know that Jewish history really is different. And if we suffer so dramatically, then we will rise just as supernaturally and just as meteorically and just as disproportionately. And that is precisely why Yeshaya enjambs both of these Nevi'im into the same pasuk, just to draw our attention to that common algorithm. When we suffer disproportionately. Shu'alim hilchubo. And when we succeed just as phenomenally. And that was the great, great laugh of Rabbi Akiva. It was a partially a laugh and partially a sneer. We snicker at history. That's what Jews do. We snicker at history. I remember when I was in yeshiva, I had to apologize to Paul and to Jonathan. I don't know what I've said before, I haven't said before, if I apologized to you. In 1987, the entire yeshiva fasted for a Soviet Jew who was imprisoned. And we lain vayichal and we said slichos and we called him in his prison cell after the fast and we said, we're fasting for you. We hope one day you'll be released. We thought 10 years, 20 years. 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, this Russian prisoner comes marching into our yeshiva in the Gush and he takes his seat in the Beis Medrash. His name is Yuli Edelstein, current Speaker of the Knesset. Some of us in this room are old enough to remember the fear we lived in of the Soviet Union. Nuclear Armageddon, nuclear war, the irrepressible Soviet Empire. Who could oppose it? A few Yidden in Moscow. We stood tall. And when Sharansky was finally released in the mid-80s, a few years later, the entire Soviet Union collapsed. That's what we are. We're empire busters. Literally. For us, they're all just paper tigers. We blow them away in the wind. blow them into the dustbin of history. Nebuchadnezzar, the great ruler who tyrannized the ancient world, he demanded that every country send an emissary to bow down to an idol. No one could dare oppose. Six-story tall idol, fires blazing, music blaring. No one dared imagine. He was the despot of his era, far, far more powerful than any despot that you have ever read about or certainly lived through. And three no-names called Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Say, we're not going into the fire. We're bowing down. Paul tosses into the fire. Kadosh Baruch Hu creates fire. He determines what burns, what doesn't burn. The snare doesn't burn, neither do we. Fire is combustion. You know, that's why Torah is compared to fire. This is maybe a little too racy for Tisha B'Av because it's actually Torah, but a little Yitzhahara. Why is Torah compared to fire? Fire is a process that requires three elements: fuel, energy, and that invisible element without which there's no oxidation, oxygen. The fuel is the wood, the oil, the coal, whatever is being. The energy is the heat, the light, the fire. And the oxygen is the shadchan. Creates the interaction between the two and leads to the oxidation and the reduction. So Torah is similar. Torah requires three components. It requires fuel, Torah. We consume the Torah, the actual Torah. The energy, which we provide with our efforts. You're all here providing a lot of energy to study Hashem's Torah. Then there's that invisible part called HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Siyata Deshmaya. Without Hashem's presence, no one can ever learn Torah. Whenever you succeed in Talmud Torah, it's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu facilitates it. And that's why at the Sneh, Torah had yet been delivered to Am Yisrael. That third component was missing, so the Sneh wasn't burning. There was no combustion. The Torah hadn't yet been given to Am Yisrael, so that third, that combination of fuel and energy didn't yet exist. They define Nebuchadnezzar, and within a few years, Nebuchadnezzar becomes a lunatic, raving the forest naked, consorting with bears. And a few years later, his empire falls. Those of you who have studied Sefer Daniel. Us empires are just paper tigers. They're conventions. So if you keep one just smiling, you're sneering. You sneered at history. To be sneering at history doesn't mean to be disrespectful to people who are part of history. You never should be disrespectful to anyone. But to sneer at the prospect that we have to succumb to the demands and the expectations of history. You know, a lot of people in Chutz La'aretz, their connection to Israel is Bibi, this politician or that politician, what's happening in the Knesset. Headline grabbers don't author history. History is authored by day-to-day life, day-to-day moral energy. People make bold decisions to raise families, to act properly, with integrity. Headline grabbers come and go. They're celebrities, they attract our attention. We believe in groupthink. Well, everyone's thinking about them, they must be important, which is obviously ridiculous, but a sad casualty of the democratic age in which we aren't free to think democratically because it is a must-see viral video. Everyone has to watch it. If everyone's watching, it must be important. The most undemocratic approach I can imagine. And Rabbi Akiva was smiling. It doesn't say he was misameach. It says Rabbi Akiva mitzachek. He was toying with it. It was almost a toy for him. He was happy. He wasn't just happy. He also was sneering. So this sense that Chazal grabbed from the triple employment of the word Echa was already sensed by Yeshaya when he juxtaposed Uriah and Zechariah. But it took Rabbi Akiva to decode Yeshaya's pasuk. Until Rabbi Akiva came along, no one really understood the pasuk in Yeshaya and the juxtaposition of the two, of Uriah and of Zechariah, and Rabbi Akiva decoded it. The truth is, there's another word, another password that captures the irrationality and the asymmetry of Jewish history. Not the word Echa, not a four-letter word, but a three-letter word. Yirmiyah stands in the quickly disintegrating ruins of Yerushalayim, in Perek Lamed Beis, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks, just have to make sure, what time? We have time, right? 10 minutes. And he asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu requests of him to purchase some land in Eretz in Yerushalayim. And What time do we have to stop? 5 minutes. Okay, so we'll discuss Yirmiyahu with only 5 minutes. We spent the whole day reading his Megillah, so we compensate. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to purchase land in Yerushalayim. And Yirmiyahu is shocked. I'm a Navi. I understand that your ways are unfathomable. I've studied Sefer Iyo. I get that concept. Purchasing land in Yerushalayim. The Babylonians are marauding through the city. The city's in flames. People are dying of pestilence and plague. It's like telling me to purchase land in Fallujah or Mosul. There's no market for it. Don't even sell it to me. Hine, source number 8. Vespalel Hashem achoriti tia sefer amikne avarach ben Eriyahu lemora. He's received the instruction to purchase land and he's dumbfounded. Ha Hashem Elokim, hine ata asisa shemayim v'saaretz. I know you're the master of heavens. Line number 3. Gadol eitzav rav aliliyah. You're the possessor of wisdom. Shenecha b'kuchos akol darchei b'nei adam. You understand human. These words are lifted from Iyov. These words are Iyov words. You understand human history and the secrets of the universe. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, line number 4, source 8. Hine asololos bo ha'ir lelachta. The ramparts are built. The custom were the mercs, were the mercenaries hired, they were the Ukrainians, hired by the Babylonians to destroy, to plunder, to decapitate. Ve'ata Marta, line number 3 from the bottom. Ne'elecha asad v'kesef, you want me to purchase land? This is ridiculous, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is illogical. And the Rabbon Shalom issues one word. A one-word answer, last line. Hine ani Hashem Elokei kol basar. Hamimeni yipolei kol davar. Is there anything which to me is a mystery? To you it's a riddle. To you it's an enigma. Hashem processes the entire eternal span of history. Events which to us seem baffling, seem ridiculous, seem frustrating. I'll just end with a story because I'm sorry we have to truncate it. We have to be somewhere else. Sometimes when I interview boys for admissions into the yeshiva, I like to ask them trick questions. One of my trick questions is, I want to know who they are as a Jew. Because part of being an Oved Hashem is just being a good Jew. I know a lot of Jews who aren't good Oved Hashem. I know a lot of good Oved Hashem who I'm not sure are good Jews. Part of it is being a good Jew. Here's a good mental experiment for the end of Tisha B'Av. Who is the best Jew that you met or read about? But there's one condition. He or she can't be from. Who is the best Jew you know or read about that was never from? That's a good way of helping you identify what it means to be a good Jew outside of how black your tefillin are and how you say Birch Samasa. To me, the answer is obvious. Begin. I wish I'd be half the Jew Begin was. I don't know that he was classically religious. I didn't check his tzitzis, but so I asked them, if you could climb into a time zone, into a time travel machine, and visit one point in Jewish history, where would you travel to? That's a good way for me to gauge, not how well you read the Tosfos, but how well you live your Judaism. So I was giving an interview about 10 years ago, and a boy said, Rabbi, which period would you go back to? So I gave him a big check for having Maxi. I like the spirit. I said, if I can go back to one stage of Jewish history, it would be in 1945 and walk out of concentration camps with survivors. Why? 2020 hindsight instructs us, what was the first thing they did when they left concentration camps? They rebuilt families, finding a niece from the shtetl or a sister's friend or a sister's daughter's brother. Someone they knew from the shtetl, let's get married, rebuild and rename. And how could you bring children to such a grotesque world of darkness and hopelessness? 2020 hindsight lets us realize that those children born in 45, 46, 40, they would march in the fields of redemption. They would change history. They would fight in the independence war. They would stand by the Knesset when we announced our independence. They would be the founding generation of our people, these heroes. But they didn't have that 2020 hindsight. They just did what was right morally, even though the world didn't accommodate their moral principles. And I would just want to feel their moral energy standing by their side, because sometimes in life you can't make sense of the broader calculus. You just have to hold the line and do what's right. even if you don't understand how it will calculate into some broader panoramic vision, you just follow your reps and you follow the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the whispers of morality, even if you don't fully appreciate how it will unfold and how it will. I mentioned one of my grandfathers before. My other grandfather, who was married actually to the step-grandmother, left Russia in 1919 as a single boy, and he collected his pennies in the United States and sent them back to bring over all of his brothers. Today, you mentioned before, I think there must be about 800 to 900 people with the last name Tarragon, 90% of whom I don't even know, because one person took a morally courageous decision and within a century changed the world. That's how you change the world. Not through flashy policy statements and flashy political maneuvers. They come and go. They move the needle ever so slightly, and the needle moves back. In no way to discredit that importance, but not at the expense of real moral behavior. Hashem tells Yirmiyah, you don't know. I mean, many of you probably, you see destruction. I see rebuilding. You see flames. I see hundreds of thousands of Jews parading to the Kotel on Yom HaTzmaot or on Shavuos or on Sukkos and Berachas Kohanim. And at that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reminds Yirmiyah that the password, it's like you have a Gmail password, if you want to read your email, the password into your real Gmail account, the Geula account, Geula mail, the password is Pella. Don't tell anyone. Pei Lamed Aleph. We read about it today. We described the fall of the Jewish people, Vateret Pleim, last night. Our fall was Peladik, as we say, was beyond comprehension. The return, Hamimene Yipole, I don't have enough time, but that's the same way HaKadosh Baruch Hu describes the end of days to Zechariah, without describing the context, but just to show you the pasuk, source 9, Ko Amar Hashem Tzivakos, Ki Yipole Be'ene She'erisam Hazeh. Those who will see this will be shocked, Gam Be'ene Yipole. Hopefully I'll speak about this pasuk in steam court, we have the final share about Zechariah. I want you to have a meaningful fast. I'm sorry, I have to walk out. We have to be somewhere else now. Meaningful fast. And the next time we see each other should be not just in Or Sameach, but in the city of Or, city of light, underneath the iridescent light of a new world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Or Chadash.